So let's look at our series then of messages that we have on No Perfect People, and we're going to get your notes out on No Perfect People. And boy, if there's something that will really remind you that none of us are perfect, it's going to be the idea of parenting. Any of you agree with that? Yeah, absolutely. And so this is what we're going to look at today a little bit. I don't know if you've heard the story of the guy that was in the grocery store with his little one who just could not be consoled, and his little boy's just screaming and crying. You can hear him when he's in the vegetable aisles. You can hear him on the other side of the store. And the whole time, this man just kept calm. And he just says, "It's okay, Tommy. Tommy's going to be all right." And he just kept consoling and kept saying, "Tommy's going to be okay, Tommy's going to be all right." And finally, this other guy is really impressed with this, and he walks up to the dad, and he goes, "I'm amazed at just how calm you try to keep your little one and keep consoling little Tommy." And the dad looks at him and says, "No, I'm Tommy." I'm Tommy. And so maybe some of you kind of feel that way. It's there's a dialogue between a dad and a son, and the dad said this. He said, "Where did you go?" And the son replies, "Nowhere." And the dad says, "Grow up, quit hanging around the public squares and wandering up and down the public streets. Go to school. Night and day you torture me. By night and day you waste your time having fun." Does that sound a little bit familiar at all? Dialogue like that. Well, let me tell you something. I want to go to the next slide. Let me tell you something here. That was written on a 4,000-year-old Sumerian clay tablet between a father and a son and the conflict that they were having. So the more we talk about stuff like this, and then when we use the Bible with things like this, it's because a lot of these issues and things that we've had in our life, they are still with us. Proverbs 24:3 says, "It takes wisdom to have a good family, and it takes understanding to make it strong." Wisdom to have a good family, understanding to make it strong. And so I want to let you know that this message applies to everyone. If you're not a parent here today, or if your kids are grown, whatever, truly this has been tailored for the needs of parents today, but the steps and applications here are applicable to everyone. You're going to see that the things that are here will make any of your relationships stronger and better if you'll just heed this and apply this to your life. So let's get right into these. I've kind of put together five of these things. And one of them with your kids is accept their uniqueness. Accept their uniqueness. Because every kid is made in a very unique way. And you need to understand, a lot of times parents want to remake children into their own image. Well, guess what? God already took that job. He said, "I've made you in my image." And don't try to remold kids to use them as an extension of your ego, because that's just not going to work. And sometimes you're going to have a kid and it says, "Whose kid is this anyway?" Because they're so mysteriously different. And of course, you already understand this. You know, if you have a kid who is a biological extension of who you are, you have this mystery of, man, they have so many characteristics like me. If you've been blessed to adopt a child, you already understand the uniqueness of this anyway. But that's true whether you have a biological extension child of yours, whether you adopt a child, both are going to be absolutely unique. And so we need to understand and recognize their uniqueness. I had a couple of friends who were in my wedding. They're identical twins, and they, I don't know if any of you know TV history, they kind of look like Richie Cunningham on, what was that show? Yeah, see, you know your TV history, okay. Yeah, they look just like him. They call him Richie all the time. Ron and Don were their names. And to everyone else, they'd always mix them up, but because I knew them well, I could tell them apart very easily. And they were incredibly different in their temperaments. And that's just the truth for all of us. I remember my father having to adjust to my personality because my older brother was a lot more like my dad. They thought the same. They did things the same. Well, apparently I took after my mom a little bit more. And since my mom was a mystery to my dad, I guess I was too. Okay. But you know, just this understanding the difference of personality, to his credit, He worked really hard to try to figure that out, and I love him for that. So 1 Corinthians 12, 6 speaks of this. It says, God works through different people in different ways. Now, who in the world did he say this to? This is 1 Corinthians 12, 6. Well, what is a Corinthian? And where is Corinth? Remember that tablet I just told you about? Real dad, real son, having a real problem 4,000 years ago. And that could have been current today. Same thing here. This is Corinth in 2,000 years ago. In fact, just look at this next slide on this. A lot of the things that we talk about with the family and what we call the family unit, all of this comes back to ancient Roman thought. The ancient Roman family, the city of Corinth was actually a Roman settled colony. And this is where Paul had gone, who wrote this book, to talk about Jesus in a lot of these places. Their culture was basically Roman. They called it familia. Yeah, well, that's where we get the word family. You didn't know that. But it comes from ancient Rome. They had a triad system, which meant they defined a family as a father and a mother and children living together in their own family unit. That was kind of a unique thing to actually define a family that way. Does that sound familiar to any of you? Okay. So when Paul's writing and he's talking about family and how to deal with marriages and whatever, this is within the culture that he is trying to present this. Pater familia, what that meant, and this is imbalanced with what the Bible says. And the Bible, when it's writing, is trying to add correctives to the culture in which these people are living. Pater familia meant this, that the man of the home had absolute sway and rule over everything. Some of you are out there going, yeah. But really, the truth is, most men are too passive. And they want to be dominating, but they don't want to take responsibility. That's what happens in a lot of homes. And pater familia, what that basically meant, if a child's born, a father could basically say whether he wanted that kid to live or not. And if he's saying, I don't want that kid to live, he'd just take it out and leave it on the side of a road. And it was against the law to rescue that child. Fortunately, during the time of Paul, Christians rescued those babies all the time. And Christians lost their lives sometimes by doing that. But it was the right thing to do. We have a more convenient way of getting rid of children today. But that isn't our message today. Parents. Where do we get the word parents? If you add a T to that, what do we get? We get the word parents. Okay, you guys are not very good on Wheel of Fortune, are you? See, P-A-R-E-N and add a T in there, you get the word parents. And that was the whole process of taking care of kids. Pater, father, mater, mother. And this is a painting that was done in 250 A.D. So this is really close to the time Paul was actually, this could have been the very type of people. You're missing the father, so you have the mother and two children right here. But that family units. But this is who Paul was talking to, and they had unique issues going on in their lives. And Paul was trying to address, because I'm sure they're coming to him and says, my children are killing me. They're driving me crazy. I don't know what to do. You know, my son doesn't respect his mother. You know, and Paul was writing letters to these new Christians trying to help them put their families back together. You know, we have all kinds of stuff that how we try to define people. We have what's called an IQ test, do we not? And an IQ test is supposed to measure how intelligent we are. Well, you know, scientists stuff have figured out there are a lot of different ways of having intelligence that didn't used to be recognized. There's emotional intelligence, there is relational intelligence, there's intuitive intelligence. And so this whole idea of trying to compare our kids, your kids are going to be compared enough in our culture. You know, they're going to measure them by this, they're going to measure them and compare them to this, and if you don't dress just this way or have just this amount of, charisma or good looks or whatever, they are going to be compared, and they don't need parents also comparing them. You know, stuff like this. You know, why can't you be tough like Billy? You know, when Billy's out on the athletic field, he gets hurt, he doesn't cry, how come you're crying? You know, I've heard things just like that. And comparing, you know, why can't you get your homework done on time just like your sister? You know, why, you know, she gets good grades. You're smart. Why can't you get good grades too? And the constant comparing of things. So another one here is judge your own actions and don't compare yourself with others. Let's go to the next slide here. This is kind of what Corinth looked like at the time. It was a rich city. It had been completely destroyed. A guy named Julius Caesar completely rebuilt this city. So by the time Paul got there, it was one of the top economies in the ancient Roman world. There's a great mixture of affluent people, and you had new people moving in. Right at the time Paul arrived here, all Jews were banned from the city of Rome. So you had tens of thousands of Jewish people who were migrating back to cities like this. So it was just like a super boom town, and you had all kinds of people that were dislocated, taken away from their families, uprooted in traumatic situations. I think there's one more slide here on this. And this is just one example. This guy here, his name is Eratus, and he's actually in Romans 16:23. Eratus, the city treasurer, greets you. This is an actual plaque that they have found. Just uncovered it recently, and basically this is the guy that they're talking about in the Bible. And it just shows that Paul was able to have influence with some of the wealthiest and highest ranking government officials in the city, as well as the poorest of the poor. So you had a wide diversity of people, some who lived in little cracker box type houses, some of those more palatial mansions, but yet they all had families and they all had family issues. And so Paul is addressing them here in this passage. But it says in another passage, judge your own actions and don't compare yourself with others. This is a completely different letter, also applying to families and to relationships in general. Judge your own actions and don't compare yourself to others. And this is in Galatians. Galatia is a completely different region that Paul had been to. The people are radically different than the Corinthians. They were not these urban kind of hip people. These were people who were knew how to fight. They were known as being very aggressive, very tribal, very clannish. They lived more in the rural areas, kind of in the mountains. And they were kind of a people to reckon with. Boy, you didn't cross their path and do them wrong. They were never very wealthy, and they're kind of in the backwaters. And in fact, here's a picture of these people here. This is called the Dying Galatian. I don't know how well you can see the images here, but they really get a picture. These were larger people. They're probably the largest people at the ancient times, and they look like these big kind of Nordic type people. And you know, his hair actually be right in style, wouldn't it? It's kind of spiky and everything. And but here they were rebelling against the Romans, and they had all these big wars. They end up losing everything. And so this is a very proud people who had been completely smashed and conquered. But then by the time Paul got there, they were super receptive to his message because they found no hope in their life. And so Paul is addressing them, and he's saying, quit trying to compare yourself to other people and quit feeling sorry for yourself, but judge by your own actions. And so you have this whole thing of the radically different cultures that Paul is writing to about concerns about their marriages and about their kids and about their families. And I find it remarkable that we can use these words that Paul wrote 2,000 years ago, and they're completely accurate and applicable to your lives right now. That is the miracle of the Word of God, you guys. That this is applicable, and that the Holy Spirit knew. Paul had no idea. When he wrote to the Corinthians, there were maybe 100 or 200 Christians in that whole city at the time. And look what has happened. I mean, the Corinthian church was probably the size of maybe our one service here. Maybe throw in the first service at the warehouse. And I don't think he had any idea of how God was going to use his teaching and words. But God knew, if I can get the truth into people's hearts and minds, I can start to heal their marriages. I can start to heal their families. And we will be able to pass on this good news from generation to generation. And that is what's happened for all of us here. And then look at another passage on this. Love does not demand its own way. Love does not demand its own way. And train up a child the way that he should go or she should go, and they will not return to it. Let's look at this next slide. On this is the temple of Aphrodite in Corinth. The reason I wanted to bring this up is this place was thriving at the time Paul was there and at the time this early Christian church was there. Some archaeologists estimate that there were 1,000 temple prostitutes that worked out of this very location here. And by prostitutes, we're not talking someone who's reached the legal age of 18. Okay? Children were just seen as other people. It was awful, absolutely awful what went on. And then you'd find a young lady who had been, you know, look at this. Love does not demand its own way. Go back, please. Love does not demand its own way. That had huge impact on the Corinthians that had temples like this. Huge impact on them that says love is not about just personal gratification. Any kind of corrupt type thing you want to do, you have absolute freedom to do it because that's what the Roman culture said. Paul was raising people up to a higher level from the Holy Spirit. Husbands, be loyal and faithful to your wives. Treat children the way Jesus wants children to be treated. And you know, we still need this type of teaching today when you have sophisticated countries with high technology and a lot of wealth, where you have the Supreme Court of that land saying it's legal for a middle-aged man to marry an 8-year-old girl. And that has just happened here last week in another country, in a Muslim marriage. These words are powerful, and if we understand them, when we apply them to our life, they have huge impact. And then the passage again, train your child in the way they should go, and when they get old, they will not turn from it. Go to that slide, please. They will not turn from it. People take this as a promise, but please understand, this can be misunderstood. This is not intended to be a promise. This is a proverb. What's the difference? A promise is an airtight thing. If I just do this, my kid's never going to embarrass me. My kid's never going to mess up. My kid's never going to sin. Is that what this is saying? No. What it's saying, it's a proverb. It's a general truth. If you basically pour into your child and do the right things, generally speaking, that's going to bear the kind of fruit that you want to see. But does your kid still have free will to do what they want to do, even though you've done the very best and the right things by them? Absolutely. But this is generally to you guys. So if we just really hang in there with this, it's really true. Now, on uniqueness, I remember as a kid, eighth grade, I missed a day at school. And apparently they organized this whole thing, and every boy in the school had to enter this wrestling tournament. And so I showed up to school the next day for this wrestling tournament, and they'd put kids according to their weight divisions. Well, in eighth grade, I was barely 5 feet tall, okay? And so I show up, and there were no categories left. The only category left, there was a slot in the heavyweight division. And so the PE teacher says, "Well, Harris, you're going in the heavyweight division." So there I was. I had no idea really what wrestling was about, and for me, it just looked like a brawl. It just looked like a fight. I was absolutely terrified. This is the truth. And so what it was, you'd put two guys out on the mat. All the rest of the guys would get in a big circle, and they just go, "Come on, get up, yeah, yeah." It's just like the regular day at my school on the playground, in the hallways, in the bathrooms. I mean, my school, man, that's happening all the time, everywhere. And so to me, it's just like, it's a throwdown fight. And so I was completely terrified. Every guy I wrestled was at least a foot taller than me, it seemed like it to be. And so I didn't know any better. And so when the guy went out there and go, wrestle, I just went crazy. I went absolutely crazy. I screamed. I ended up pinning every single one of my opponents because I was just, but it was a trauma for me. You know, and so I ended up like taking first place in the heavyweight division as this little tiny guy. And then the varsity coach for the high school says, "You're going to wrestle for me next year." And so I went and I wrestled for him and I was pretty good. But it dawned on me, I hated it. I hated what I was doing. I was good at it, but I hated doing that thing. And my father finally, he heard me say that, "Man, I don't like doing this." He says, "Well, why are you doing it, John? If you're not wired and set up to really do this, why are you doing that?" And he gave me the freedom to be who I was instead of doing stuff. Any of you get caught in stuff because you're good at it, you end up doing it, but it's not really who you are? See, we can do this with our kids. You know, accept the uniqueness of who these kids are. Another one is affirm their value. Affirm their value. If you really want to help your kids, who are going to be imperfect, and you're going to be imperfect also, but affirm their value. Let them know. Most parents are adults that are raising kids. You know what? They feel deeply about these kids, but a lot of times they just don't let them know enough. Most kids do not hear from their parents. They don't hear them say enough what they feel. You know, kids will hear once in a while. They don't hear near enough. It says in Psalm 139, "You made my whole being. You formed me into my mother's womb in a body. I praise you because you made me in an amazing and wonderful way." Let me give you some practical guidelines on this. Well, how can you do this? How can you affirm their value of who they are? One is just pay attention to them. I notice so much in our culture, your attention is demanded of you, and so we have learned to multitask. And so much of listening to kids, especially when they get older, you know, and I think kids get in almost in their teen years, I think they need way more affection, and it's kind of harder to give, and they might not reciprocate or respond to it, but inside they're going, yeah, that's what I need, okay? And they're going, stop it, come on, Mom, don't do that, but inside, that's totally what they're thinking and what they need. The first one here is attention. Give them attention. How do you do this? Give them attention. Mother Teresa was known for this. One of her greatest qualities was that if anyone ever talked to her, the rest of the world stopped. And she would get right up to that person and gaze right into their eyes and look into their eyes intently as they talked to her. You know, we don't do a lot of eye looking in our culture. Have you noticed that? American culture, we stand pretty well, you know, if we were to have a break here, we stand pretty well apart, you know, at least 3 feet. And a lot of times we have our hands in our pockets and we're kind of this, and we're doing this. I really notice this like when I go to another country such as Romania and Italy, because whenever I talk to someone, I know everything they've eaten that day. Okay, I see it in their teeth. I could smell, oh, they've had garlic, you know, whatever. And they get this close to each other. Spittle is a part of the daily deal. I mean, they don't care. And they're just really close, and they're really in your. And so if you're talking to them, they're just right here. But this whole thing, there's a quality there of really paying attention when they're there. Because a lot of times we're multitasking. We're doing, yeah, that's great. Another one is affection. It might not be natural to you. I know some people say that. You know, I never received a lot of physical touch, and so I'm not comfortable with that. Well, why rob your kids of that? Even if you're not comfortable doing that, physical touch, appropriate physical touch, is so important. Sometimes you just have to grab, especially to get a little older, sometimes you just have to grab them, and they're going to resist. Oh, come on, you know, come here, you know, you just give them a hug or whatever. They won't forget that. Because, you know, that little kid is still inside there. And another one is appreciation. Even if they're doing things they're already supposed to do, just appreciation can be so important. Why do so many parents hold back compliments? I don't understand, but they do. In our men's fraternity, we've learned that dads tend to be way harder on their own kids than they are other kids. Why is that? Why do we hold back? There's no reason to hold back. The Bible says there's no reason to hold back. We should always be building them up, always be praising them for appropriate things. But when they're doing the things they normally should be doing, give them appreciation too. Instead of, well, they ought to be doing that. They should be doing that. I always did that when I was their age. You know, just dismiss all of that. A word of encouragement does wonders. Proverbs 12:25. They did a survey of teens. They said, who do you want to please most? 99% of the teens said, I want to please my parents. Second question, how do you know when you please them? Number one answer, I don't know. Nothing I ever do seems to please them. At least that's what they're thinking. Number three, trust them with responsibilities. Jesus trusted a small group of young men with the greatest treasure in the world. And it seemed to work okay because we're here today. That could have completely died in Israel 2,000 years ago, but it didn't. They made statues of all these guys in St. Peter's Basilica, now in the Vatican City. You know, these little upstart guys, and Jesus trusted them. We have to have a way of trusting our own kids. This is set up biblically, not culturally. Get them to do more for themselves. Not in the way our culture says, just in the way the Bible says. You can still help, you can still assist, but more and more you need to teach them from the day they're born to where they will eventually grow up and be able to be on their own. What does that mean? Don't always rescue them. Don't always excuse them. I know some of the toughest jobs are youth pastor and educators because it has to do with our kids. And if something comes up, guess what? Well, they must be a bad youth pastor. Or they must be a lousy teacher because my kid should never have a problem. My kid should never have a behavioral problem. Boy, in my home, it was just the opposite. I mean, they understood when something was unjust or unfair. I knew my mom and dad understood that. But if it ever came down to the teacher's opinion on something and my opinion on something, guess who's in the wrong? It's going to be me. Now, understand, they understood unfair and unjust. But boy, I tell you what, they taught me a lot about respecting the authority of those that were over me because I had a big problem that way. And I'm happy when I look back on it now. And so we don't make excuses for our kids all the time. Don't rescue them all the time. Sometimes they need to go through the lessons for the things that have happened in their life. Does that make sense to you all? Okay, we are each responsible, Galatians 6:5, we're each responsible for our own conduct. Number four, correct them without condemning them. Correct them without condemning them. You'd be amazed at what you have to tell your kids not to do. Have you ever thought about that? You know, just some of the stuff. Honey, do not put the Play-Doh in the DVD player, please. please do not use a garbage bag as a parachute and try to jump off of the roof. What are you thinking? You know, stuff, don't take your fishing pole out of the toilet. That is not a fish in there. Okay. Here is one that was told to me as a kid. Son, pack up, quit creating a casino out of our garage. I found a roulette wheel and playing cards, and man, I had a going thing there, man. I had like 25, 30 kids, and we had stacks of quarters, all kinds of stuff. It was going great. And, you know, that's the pastor's kid in the neighborhood. So my dad never thought he'd have to say, please don't create a casino. And another one he had to tell me, too, is, John, quit creating little bombs and teaching the other kids how to create little bombs, okay? Because 4th of July, they had the, you know, right next to us, they had these big, you know, fireworks displays and whatever. Well, I don't know how it happened. I watched one of these little things. You know, they shoot up and you see all the things. It went way up. Well, this thing didn't explode, and it came all the way back down with that little sparky thing on it, all the way to the ground. It was out there on the middle of the football field, still kind of sparking. So I took off after it. I took off after this thing, sprinted all the way out there, and there's this little fuse on it, and I kind of yanked it out, and then I had this thing that hadn't blown up. Okay? Now, did I think through, what if the fuse would have beat me to the, I didn't think that through. And I brought it back, and we had all these little chunks and stuff, and we made all of, anyway, my dad had to say, John, please quit creating bombs in our neighborhood. All right. If you refuse to discipline your son, it proves you don't love him. That goes for your daughter, too. If you just want him to be your best friend and you never want him to be unhappy with you, guess what? That's not real love. Another one here, correct your children while there is hope. Don't let them destroy themselves because you can be self-destructive. And there is a limit that you can do, an influence you can have over their life. Now, biblically, we understand it's never too late. Developmentally, if you talk with law enforcement and other people, there is kind of an age limit where you can still really form. You know, kids are like wet cement, and cement starts to harden and starts to form. So please don't do that. But when you correct, don't correct in anger. Don't keep on scolding and nagging your children, making them angry and resentful. Rather, bring them up with a loving discipline with suggestions and godly advice. That's Ephesians 6:4 that I just read to you, and it's in your notes. Because, again, back in Roman times, who was the head of the home? The pater familia, the man. He could do whatever he wanted. In fact, they had legends of a man who was leader of Rome, and two of his sons in battle had done great victories, but they had defied his orders. He had his sons executed in front of all of the Roman soldiers because he could do it, and you shall not defy your father. So you could have an incredibly harsh type of parenting. And I'm sure Paul had these new Christians, but they still had cultural ideas on how to be a parent. And so there's a whole lot of history behind these scriptures here. But with us, I have heard such anger come out. You know, and I have had times in my life, especially in the car. What is it with kids in the back seat of the car? I don't know what it is. He's touching me. No, he's touching me. He's touching. Do not touch each other. Then what do? They sit here. They blow on each other. And so I remain calm, and then I turn into like one of those demons. You know, my head spins around. Stop. You know what I mean? You just go from calm and turn into that. You know, it's like hoping that they will finally react. But, you know, that's not the best way, and I've learned to do this better over the years. But that comes to words, too. Watch your words. Don't use harmful words. Please don't do that. Use only helpful words, the kind that build up. So you need the discipline, but there's got to be a way that you do this. And number five, love them unconditionally. Love them unconditionally. I prayed about my kids before. Says, dear God, give me wisdom. What should I do? How should I do things? And I've listened to God. Says, God, please tell me, what should I do? How should I do things? And after all of that, I would sit and I'd meditate. And you know what came out? You know what came out in the still small voice to how I know God talks to me? You know what came out? It was amazing. It was this. Love. And I just sat and really start thinking about that. Loving unconditionally. Let me read you something that's from Nancy Ging. Wrote an article. She's a parent of a child with special needs. And as you know, this can present unique challenges. She said, last summer, my daughter who has Down syndrome taught me that sometimes God speaks among those challenges. Sarah's heart surgeries and many challenges were finally over. Now we're facing all kinds of medical bills. On top of that, my husband's job was going to probably be eliminated within a few weeks. And so losing her house seemed inevitable. As I closed my eyes to pray about this, I felt a small little hand on my arm. Mommy, said little Sarah, and she stutters. I just got ready for vacation Bible school all by myself. And next to the bed stood 5-year-old Sarah, her eyes twinkling, and she exclaimed, ta-da! I noticed her shorts were on backwards. A price tag hung from a new top also on inside out. She had chosen unmatched socks, her shoes were on the wrong feet, and she wore a baseball cap turned sideways. I packed the backpack too, she stutters. I gazed inside. 5 Lego blocks, a box of paper clips, a fork, an undressed doll, 3 jigsaw puzzle pieces, and a crib sheet. Gently lifting her chin up until our eyes met, I said, Sarah, you look beautiful. Thank you, said Sarah as she twirled around like a ballerina. The mother goes on, now I intended to change her, but as that morning minutes dissolved into urgent seconds, I realized I wasn't going to have time to do that. I decided to wait until we got to the church. I tried to reason to Sarah about her backpack. Honey, I don't think you'll be needing that backpack. Why don't you let mommy take that backpack off? She goes, no, I need it. And so when they got to the church, I attempted to redo Sarah's outfits, and she pulled away, reminding me of my earlier morning words. No, you said I look beautiful. Overhearing our conversation, a vacation Bible school teacher joined in. You do look beautiful, Sarah. And then she turned to me and she says, You can pick up Sarah at 11:30, and we'll take good care of her. While Sarah was at Vacation Bible School, I took the other two kids, and I ran errands, and all the while my thoughts rang with anxiety. What will the future hold? How will I provide for our three small kids? These painful questions even caused me to wonder if God even loved us. I got back to the church a few minutes early. I could see the kids sitting in a semicircle listening to a Bible story. And there was Sarah sitting with her back to me, clutching her backpack. Her baseball cap, shorts, and shirt were still on backwards. But watching her from a distance, I became aware of an emotion welling up within me. And one thought rushed into my mind. I sure do love her. And then as I stood there, I heard that still small voice I have learned to understand as the Lord. That's the way I feel about you. I closed my eyes and I started to imagine the Lord looking at me from a distance. My life so much like Sarah's backward outfit, unmatched, mixed up. I sure do love you, he said to me. Why are you holding that backpack so full of doubts, anxieties, and fears? She said, I heard God saying to me, let me carry it. Come on now. Give me your fear-filled backpack, those useless things. Give it to the one who says, you are precious in my sight. I love you. And then she finishes. That night, I thank God for the privilege of parenting Sarah, because through her, God's unconditional love was revealed to me in a whole new way. How do our kids know they're loved unconditionally? How do we parent? You know, to put this in a nutshell, how do we parent as Christian parents, if you're a follower of Jesus here? Just treat your kids the way God treats you. Does that make sense? We can take all of these things, appreciate their uniqueness, their value, give them responsibilities, correcting properly, love unconditionally. All those things work in all relationships. They certainly are so appropriate in parenting. I have a couple of closing scriptures here. I think there are two huge things when it comes to parenting. I think the first is this. You can write this down somewhere in your notes. Forgive your kids for the things that they do. Your kids are going to hurt you so many times. I don't think a parent gets out of the parenting career without a kid saying to them at least once, I hate you. You're so mean. You have the privilege of forgiving your children over and over and over again. In fact, Paul wrote to the early Roman families who could have been very harsh. He says in Ephesians 4:32, be kind and loving to each other, forgiving each other, just as God forgave you in Christ. And then another thing, never give up on your children. I've talked with children who've had tears that said their parents have looked at them and says, you're useless. I don't want to see you. I don't want to own you as my child anymore. Never give up on your children. You know, we have a lot of kids, they're going to work through recovery issues in their life, and it's going to be a bumpy road. It could be bumpy for a long time. But boy, if you ever want them to get well, never give up on them. It says, if you love someone, you will always believe in him and always expect the best of him. Look at this parent's prayer together here. I will try to walk a blameless path But how I need your help, especially in my home where I long to act as I should. There are no perfect parents. There are no perfect children. By the grace of God, if we follow practical biblical steps that were relevant then and they're relevant now, we can bring tremendous healing in our families, and the type of unhealthy things that maybe you experienced in a family growing up, you can break that pattern if you insert this biblical balm, this biblical healing into your lives. Why don't we do that together? God bless.